presents the News Quiz with your chairman, Simon Hoggart.
Hello and welcome again to the News Quiz, sadly the last in this series. And we start with a cutting from the Caterham Parish Magazine, read by Charlotte Green.
A bean supper will be held on Tuesday evening in the church hall. Music will follow.
Thank you, Nikki Ramage of Caterham, for sending us that. Now let's meet the teams. Please welcome first on my right, Guardian columnist Francis Ween and comedian Steve Punt. And facing them on my left, the Times' Alan Corran and Miles Kington of The Independent. And before we start round one, here's an apology seen in Scotland on Sunday.
In last week's review of Jean House Alloa, honey roast whale is not on the menu. It should have read quail.
Thanks to all the listeners who spotted that. Francis, which Balkan bounty fueled controversy in the coffers?
The Conservative Party has a long record of accepting money from interesting businessmen. Azor Nadir. Saddam Hussein, I think, slipped them the odd fiver. But this is to do with a Yugoslav, not to say a Serb businessman, who apparently gave them 100,000 quid. And we have to tread a bit carefully here, because this chap, Johnny Serb, as he's named for security purposes, we don't know his real name, but he has issued a solicitor's letter from Peter Carter Ruck saying you better watch your step because he didn't do anything wrong. But the original suggestion was that he'd given them 100,000 quid and perhaps that this had in some way influenced the government's policy towards Bosnia, i.e. to do nothing. But in fact, they did that without the bribe. They do that anyway. He's denied that. He said he's never even met Radovan Karadzic. He just is a struggling businessman trying to earn an honest crust and gave them 100,000 quid and hoped for a peerage like anyone else. And it was all quite above board.
Indeed, 2 points, the allegation that a Serbian businessman donated over £100,000 to Conservative Party funds. The government denied such a gift could compromise their neutrality in Bosnia as they'd just as easily accept money from Muslims as well. However, witnesses in a Mayfair club reported seeing a Tory minister receiving wads of cash from a mysterious stranger. They were immediately suspicious, as it's usually the other way round. Steve, who studiously offered a loan for what used to be taken for granted?
Well, this would be New Labour. This is a new Labour policy, and you know it's a new Labour policy because it's a Conservative policy. It's just two grants and replace them with a compulsory loan. The idea is that you take out this loan and you repay it over 20 years after you graduate. And to me, a loan that you repay over 20 years is a mortgage, basically. You're having to take out a mortgage on your education. And what that means, presumably, is that you have to have a survey done before they'll give you a loan. So there'll be people going around universities with damp meters and saying, so we're not giving you any money because we think there's subsidence in your A-level results. And the other terrible thing about mortgages is that when any group of people gather together who have mortgages, they talk about their mortgages. And to me, a student union bar is a place for people to talk about, you know, what's wrong with the world, putting the world to rights, beer, sex, those sorts of things. And students up and down the country in future are going to be gathering around saying, oh, it's all 7.34%. Well, my APR is 8.2%. But I get £4,000 cash back, which, terrible, I think, terrible.
And then what happens if they fall behind with their payments? They get repossessed.
Their degree gets taken away.
This is the Labour Party's decision to abandon its commitment to student grants. Under the new proposal, students will be entitled to a much larger loan, repayable over the first 20 years of their working lives. It's expected to amount to around £10 a week, or one penny for each hamburger they sell. Miles, welcome back to the News Quiz. Who said it could be you making too much?
I'm just going to talk to Uncle Alan for a moment.
He can't read it. Pay back the student loan immediately.
I spent 20 years at Punch not being able to read this man's writing. Now here I am again. I think this is about the lottery, isn't it?
It is.
The lottery has been told that they're making far too much money and they ought to give it to charity. I speak in some ignorance of this subject. I've never worked out how to buy a lottery ticket. So it's not my money, so I'm not interested. But I'm still paying back my student loan, actually. City of them. I shouldn't have played poker at university, I suppose. There you go.
The MPs want, amazing. The MPs want the lottery to give money back to charity. Having set this thing up totally speciously, rather than have any sort of policy for doing anything with our gross national product, they say, let's have a lottery and everybody can stand up and put things. Now they say it's too much. I don't know why they're so
upset.
But
the charity they want it given to is the Tory Party Aid Fund.
That's right, the ethnic money laundering. National lottery profits and methods were criticised by Offlot this week. And after all, who could trust an organisation that managed to get rid of Anthea Turner but saw Bob Monkhouse as an improvement? A committee of MPs agreed they were a poor gamble that wouldn't survive but for a gullible public, and Camelot weren't any better. Alan, will you listen to this?
When Johnny comes marching home again, hooray, hooray, we'll give him a hearty welcome then, hooray, hooray.
All the men will cheer and the boys will shout, the gals dress up and they'll all turn out,
and we'll all feel gay when Johnny comes marching home.
That's wonderful news. You mean the Americans are coming in on our side now? We normally have to wait 3 years for them to come in. Why was it an American song? I know, I'm pretty sure what this is about.
Yes, it is.
Especially in a week when did you see the Germans, Simon, are building a new Zeppelin? Zeppelin are going back into business. It's a wonderful story in the Telegraph, and I thought, this is really good, they're building a Zeppelin, and we're going to retaliate in Germany, and it's going to be really quite exciting. Finally, Europe gets interesting. It's cuffs off. And
well, we're not the only ones that've got war cabinets. They've got a war cabinet too.
Oh, it's wonderful that we have. I thought we had a war. We actually do have it. They've called it a war cabinet. It's joyous. All that to keep Theresa Gorman happy. I know how to put a. I know how to put a smile on the face of Theresa Gorman. You have to be a braver man than most soldiers at the front. But yes, I think what that wonderful song was alluding to was the fact that Britain is at last going to behave really stupidly about Europe instead of behaving slightly stupidly about Europe up to now.
But it's all over bull's semen, for want of a better word, and
I'm glad
tallow,
you put that the right way round, rather than
gelatin and things like that. And we're just going to fire this stuff into Europe. It's something to do with the historic right of Britain to export bull's semen to every country in Europe, and they've got to have it whether they like it or not. It sounds like some horrible Damien Hirst art installation.
How do you get bull semen in illegally? I mean, it must be dodgy going to the Green Channel and the French customs official says, what's that? And you just say, it's a bottle of Wincarnis. I never travel anywhere. I'm an Englishman. Well, would you mind just unscrewing it and pouring it into this little flask? Very embarrassing, actually.
I think you're allowed as much as you want to take in for your own personal use, aren't you? Yes, Alan, 2 points to you. John Major has declared war on Europe. He's gone as far as establishing a whole new special department for non-cooperation with Europe, known as the Conservative Party. It's hoped that the first stage will lead to a lifting of the ban on beef byproducts, leaving John Major as the Prime Minister known to history as he who gave a helping hand to the production of bull's sperm. The scores at the end of round one are Francis and Steve 4, Alan Miles 4. We start round two with a cutting scene in the Surrey Comet.
The site is due to be developed, and there are questions which arise when an area which has been a burial ground is to be built on, and a number of bodies start to take an interest.
Thank you, H. Byer of Middlesex, for that. Francis, your second question, why is royalty due more credit?
Prince Charles.
Yes.
Who has for years had to cope with Princess Diana's shopping mania. And he's now found a way of profiting from it. I think he's turning himself into some kind of bank. The bank that likes to say, okay, yeah. And he's issuing a credit card. So when she goes to Chanel or whatever these shops are she attends... in her duties, she does it on his plastic, and he then gets some sort of APR, whatever that may be. Anyway, that's what it is. It's part of his money-making enterprise down in Highgrove. Because he really started with biscuits, which are actually quite nice. The Prince of Wales biscuits, especially the ginger ones, are very good. And then he spoiled it a year or two ago by issuing Prince of Wales fruit juice, which is the most disgusting thing. It tastes like that pink stuff you get at the dentist to rinse with. And he sells it at about £5 a bottle, all proceeds to go to his divorce.
What's it made of? What fruit's in it?
Well, I think bulls may have been involved.
Credit card is expected to be given an enthusiastic welcome by the aristocracy, as Camilla was overheard saying she couldn't wait to get her hands on his flexible friend. 2 points to Francis. Steve, who is entitled to sell his titles?
Yes. This is the Marquis of Bristol, who's decided to sell a load of his titles at auction because he's hard up, because being a good upstanding member of the British aristocracy, he was in prison for 10 months for possessing drugs. And so he's selling off all these titles. And in the newspaper report I read of this story, it said that you know, he's very hard up, he'd squandered the family fortune, and that from now on he would have to divide his time between the Bahamas and a farm in Suffolk. So you've got to feel really sorry for the guy, really, haven't you? Obviously really hard up. And, yes, he's selling off a load of rather meaningless titles. But he's the Marquis of Bristol, but he lives in Suffolk, which I don't really understand. I think this always happens with the British aristocracy. Prince Andrew is the Duke of York, but he lives in Windsor, and Prince Charles is the Duke of Cornwall, but he lives in Gloucestershire. So, really,
the Redemption lives next door to Dennis Skinner in Derbyshire.
You see, it's stupid. Mm. I mean, this is absolutely stupid. They ought to have a rule, the aristocracy, like with British Telecom, that if you move... You know, if you're the Marquis of Bristol and you decide to move to Suffolk, you have to phone up aristocratic hotline and you say, I'm moving, and they say, well, you can't be Marquis of Bristol anymore. Because what's the Marquis of Suffolk going to do when the Marquis of Bristol moves in next door? And they'll have to move next up to the Duke of Norfolk because he lives in Kent. So he's, I mean, it's ridiculous.
We could always put 01 in front of his name.
There was a report in the paper, actually, that the Duke of Somerset is moving from Wiltshire to Devon, so he's going through Somerset.
Miles, will you listen to this?
I am the morning DJ at WOLD. Playing all the hits for you, wherever you may be. The bright good morning voice, who's heard but never seen. Feeling all of 45, going on 15.
Miles, which Paul has been pulled off Mike?
I fear this is a reference to Paul Gambaccini.
It is.
I kept meaning to switch on Radio 3 to see what he sounded like, and now I never can. I thought for a long while, actually, Gambaccini was a very rare opera.
It's Spanish for a very small prawn.
Prawn, right. The Gambaccini are off this week, yeah. And I can't make out from reading between the lines whether he's actually going or being pushed.
It said he was the most hated man on radio. It disappointed all of us, didn't it? I think he's a very nice man. I like him.
He seems very nice, but I mean, I don't see why you shouldn't introduce classical music in an American voice. I went to America once. I heard a classical radio station, which was sponsored by an insurance firm. They said, Mendelssohn died young, and he didn't look after himself properly. If he'd insured with us, he would have been... That's how Radio 3 should be.
But I don't think it's because he's American, is it? It's because he used to be a Radio 1 DJ, and it's thought improper for Radio 1 DJs to be allowed out onto other channels.
Look, when Chris...
Which is a very sound policy, because that way we'd never have had to put up with Noel Edmonds all these years. He's stuck on Radio 1. But I think it's just snobbery, isn't it? They're going to have Steve Wright on Classic FM quite soon, apparently. Or is it Gary Davis? One of those people.
It's like being in some sort of terrible old person's home, isn't it?
What's the tea today, Francis?
This is Paul Gambaccini, the Canadian DJ who's to be dropped from Radio 3 amid some confusion at Radio 3. They think a DJ is what you wear to read the news. However, Radio 3 refused to entertain... Radio 3 refused to entertain the notion that Mr. Gambaccini was sacked for doing to Radio 3 what Gerry Anderson did to Radio 4. Anderson was pilloried for dragging radio down market with his afternoon show, whereas Gambaccini is on in the mornings. Alan, who was Home Secretary and Chancellor while holding other positions?
Oh, what an elegantly. What an elegant... In the Bull Seaman Week, what an elegantly... I hope it was going to be the Vulture. Are we going to do the one about the vulture being taught to fly by its trainer? Wonderful. Did you see it in the Daily Mail? Wonderful. Bloke in a Pringle sweater and black trousers jumping up and down with a vulture staring at him. The vulture can't fly. And he wants to learn to fly. And its trainer is jumping up and down to show him that. And the vulture will have to go out and get a red Pringle sweater, I suppose. How will it work out what it's got to do?
He's looking very hungrily at the trainer, I thought.
I think, no, the trainer will have to eat somebody. And the vulture will finally twig. Do you remember that great... there's American humorist called Kin Hubbard. Has a wonderful line. 1920s American humor. He said, there's nothing a vulture hates more than a glass eye. I believe that the question asked some... here's one I prepared earlier. The question asked some moments ago, to which I now refer the chairman, is to do with that great and good man, Lord Jenkins of Hill Head. Big hill, great head, as they used to say. And he wrote a wonderful biography of Gladstone, who was a man who went out at night and collected women. Not a bad thing to do. And Jenkins has apparently done the same. And he's been... nearly said shagging. He's been seeing all sorts of illustrious women in all sorts of interesting places, or all sorts of interesting places on all sorts of illustrious women, including, I believe, Lee Radziwill and several Kennedys. I mean, dozens of Kennedys. The Kennedys have been going through him like a dose of... Yeah. Very encouraging for the rest of us who are slightly thin on top and a bit doddery, drink too much claret. There is hope for all of us. I hope that's the question, otherwise his lawyers are going to be round. Never mind, Peter Carter Rutt.
Well, he hasn't admitted it.
It's about Roy Jenkins, that great good man who is celibate.
Oh, no,
laid a finger on her.
No, there's a
BBC... Kennedy don't know the meaning of the word.
No, there's a BBC documentary which alleges this, but he doesn't comment. He says he'll neither confirm nor deny it, because it would be like giving away budget secrets. Odd analogy, but I suppose he's former Chancellor Exchequer, so he thinks in those terms.
I'd like to hear Roy Jenkins actually saying the name Radziwill.
It's not like budget secrets. Booze up, cigs up, Roy up.
Well, he's always had an eye for a good figure. When he was Chancellor, he used to lie in bed at night scrutinising vital statistics, I believe.
What's into them?
Nothing. Doing his boxes, it was called.
The question was about a BBC documentary which claims Roy Jenkins, while a cabinet minister, had a number of affairs in the 60s, which is very impressive since most people lose count after a dozen or so. His wife became suspicious when someone on TV announced Roy Rogers, and he leapt up and demanded to buy the negatives. Jenkins was both Chancellor and Home Secretary, and it's even suggested that he might have made a Prime Minister. But Margaret Thatcher denies it. The scores at the end of round two are, of course, Francis and Steve 8, Alan and Miles up there with 8. And we begin round three with a notice in All Saints Church magazine, Lightwater.
The ladies of the church have cast off clothing of every kind, and they may be seen in the basement on Friday.
Thank you, A. Scott of Hereford, for that. So, Steve, here's a piece of music for you.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
Steve, how has Britain failed its history lessons?
Yes, don't know much about history. I think this is one of those hardy annual news stories, much beloved of the Daily Mail particularly, where someone does a survey of teenagers and they find that they don't know anything about anything, or at the very least that they don't know as much as teenagers used to know 20 years ago, and education standards are falling, it's all terrible. And I'm in fact now old enough to remember that 20 years ago, when I was 13, there were surveys saying that 13-year-olds didn't know anything as much as 13-year-olds did 20 years before. So presumably we can't go on forever like this. At some point we reach a kind of troglodyte nadir where teenagers just don't know anything at all and their knuckles start to scrape the ground because they don't know who fought at Agincourt, and we can just have done with it. But this was a survey that someone did, and they asked 13 to 16-year-olds lots of questions about history, and the finding that caught all the headlines, quite rightly, was that they asked them, and I have to say it's a bit of a leading question, but it's a good one, they asked them who Thomas Chippendale was. And almost all of them said that he was a member of the Chippendales. Which is marvellous. But on the other hand, we have to remember that although obviously all Radio 4 listeners will know that Thomas Chippendale was an 18th century furniture designer, the fact is that that was presumably just his day job. Right. Now, we don't know what Thomas Chippendale did in an evening. After a hard day's furniture designing, he might well have gone home, thought, I'm a bit, you know, I'm covered in wood shavings, whipped off his periwig and pumped iron for a few hours, you know, earned a few extra bob, popping down the coffee bar. The chief thing about this, though, is that if the country's teenagers really believe that Chippendale was a member of the Chippendales, then they must get very confused when they're watching the Antiques Roadshow. Because when the bloke says, yes, this is a genuine Chippendale, presumably they've got a mental image of a load of people in bow ties and posing pouches making card tables, which is a little bit strange, really, but...
Yes, this is a survey which showed how little the British know about their heritage. People were caught out by simple questions on ancient history, such as Agincourt, Bosworth Field and Labour Party election victories. Equally bad on recent events such as the Falklands War, and one little old lady couldn't even remember which direction the Belgrano was sailing. Very right on audience here. Francis, who met his Waterloo après le deluge?
Well, that survey that you mentioned earlier, by the way, revealed that 93% of teenagers think the Battle of Waterloo took place in a tube station during the rush hour. But, in fact, as we all know, it was won on the playing fields of Eton. And yet another new bit of research has now found that it was all because of a volcano erupting in Indonesia. Seems to make perfect sense to me. A volcano erupted in Indonesia, scattered ash around the place. There was torrential rain all over the world for the next month or two, including in Belgium on the fields where the Battle of Waterloo took place. And poor old Napoleon wasn't a very big chap, so he was struggling to squelch his way through this quagmire. But the British were quite used to this because they'd all played the war game at Eton, so they won. So we won entirely thanks to this volcano.
Is that Wellington right? Shot off to Belgium because Michael Fish said that a volcano was definitely not about to erupt in Indonesia.
Absolutely right. This is the theory that Napoleon's army was defeated at Waterloo because of the rainy weather. Muddy conditions caused a delay. The French had to sleep on horseback. But with the terrible dirt and the awful smell, those poor horses never got any sleep. A pall of ash and the explosion at Mount Tabora in Indonesia caused the weather in Belgium to become dull, wet and overcast for 180 years. Miles, why is the luck of the Irish nothing to make a song and dance about?
It must be a plot. It must be a plot. I've been saying this for years. The Irish haven't got the sense to put in a good song and lose. Every year, the Eurovision Song Contest is swapped between Norway and Ireland, but mostly between Ireland. And the economy cannot take another Eurovision Song Contest in Ireland. I mean, I just feel sorry for the people. Why don't they do the decent thing, withdraw? I mean, stage it one last time and then say, right, that's it, that's it.
I thought the Irish had always done the decent thing, withdrawn, but it's still about 5 years.
The question was about the curse of Eurovision that struck Ireland again when they won for the fourth time in 5 years, meaning that poor old RTE faces yet another bill for £3 million. This year's winner was The Voice, sung by Amir Quinn, and it beat the UK entry into seventh. The Icelandic entrant sang a number called in Icelandic Rúg, though that was only in the bar when Terry Wogan came in. 2 points to Miles. Alan, who kidded on to make old bones?
Odd is this question, to do with the fact that they found our common ancestor in a suitcase at the Natural History Museum?
Yes.
Oh, I thought it was. Sounded like it. Well, Piltdown Man.
That's where.
Piltdown Man was originally believed to be a genuine thing, then they thought it was a hoax. And now they've found a canvas bag at the Natural History Museum.
A handbag.
And they found that Piltdown Man was born in it. The two knees, a Mesozoic bowel movement, and a packet of Piltdown fags and a Piltdown lighter. It was something of a giveaway. And it belonged to this chap, Malcolm Hinton, I think it was, who invented Piltdown Man. He got a lot of old bones and bits of disused bull. And assembled them and dug a hole and said, look, I've discovered Piltdown Man, he's our common ancestor. And they said, what a clever fellow you are. And he had stuff left over. I mean, he had Piltdown Woman and Piltdown Football Team, Piltdown United, everything in these bags all over the country. And they all turned up this week, these bits of various men he didn't get a chance to spanner together.
Perfectly true, yes. It's the latest story in the saga of Piltdown Man. Investigations have revealed the identity of the hoaxer to be Martin Hinton, then curator of the Natural History Museum back in 1912. Professor Brian Gardner found the evidence there hidden in a trunk. If it had been stuck up at the other end of the mammoth, they'd never have found it. So 2 points to Alan, and before we reveal the final scores, let's see what cuttings the teams have brought along. Francis.
Yes, Simon, this is a cutting from the Daily Telegraph, sports page, ice hockey to be precise. Newcastle Warriors have been fined 2,000 Swiss francs, approximately £1,100, by the International Ice Hockey Federation for playing Swedes Lars Tunnell and Niklas Gulliksson when they were eligible.
Steve.
Yes, because this is the last programme of the series, I thought I'd update a story from a few weeks ago on the programme. Magistrates in Cardigan refused to allow a hen and a duck into court to demonstrate how well they got on with Dino, a Jack Russell Terrier accused of worrying a neighbour's poultry. The dog's owner wanted to use the animal witnesses to try to prove that the accusation was a case of mistaken identity. He was convicted but conditionally discharged for 6 months. At the verdict, Dino could be heard whimpering and the hen laid an egg.
Miles.
Well, I was reading The Sun this week. I only read The Sun when I do the news quiz. It's a fine paper, interesting. And there's a story which goes like this. A royal cop lost top secret plans to the homes of Prince Charles and Princess Anne in the street. An incredible security blunder. PC David Knight left a folder containing details of sophisticated alarm systems on his car roof, and he drove off forgetting the papers. The documents, an idiot's guide for any would-be assassin, went flying. Luckily, they were found by a man who handed them to The Sun when he saw how sensitive they were.
Alan.
Well, we've had a lot of cuttings this week that Charlotte's read from various of Lily's newsletters up and down the country, but none, I think, quite so heartrending as this from Bellingham Parish Pump. And it says, following the discovery that the bar billiards machine, the piano, and the two table tennis tables bequeathed by the late Mrs. Ellen Amory are all beyond repair, the parish council has regretfully decided not to implement the motion passed at last month's meeting, change the name of Bellingham Village Hall to Bellingham Leisure Centre.
Thank you all, and now let's look at the final score. They're tied on 17 all. And before we leave you, here's a story spotted in The Observer.
The ancient port of Sandwich has failed the EU clean beach test thanks to floating sewage. This does not go down well with residents. Among them, Jonathan Aitken, the Tory MP. He's very supportive, a neighbour said, but he's having difficulty getting his teeth into it.
With that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Alan Corrin, Francis Wheen, Miles Kington and Steve Punt. The chairman was Simon Hoggart and the news was read by me, Charlotte Green. The programme was written by Ian Pattinson with Hugh Rycroft and Adam Bostock-Smith. The production assistant was Alison Harbert and the producer was Aled Evans.